So, David Breakspeare, thank you so much for doing this with me. We first met on LinkedIn, and you saw a podcast I'd done with a couple of former career criminals, probably you'd call them. And we started chatting on LinkedIn, and then I said, come on, let's do a podcast. So I have purposely not researched you because I want to hear about you and your life for the first time on this interview. And then we can just chat. I want to find out all about your life. You know that my big thing is mental toughness. Yeah. And I would just like you to tell me and everyone listening, who are you? What has your life been like? What's happened? Where are you now?
Okay, well, who I am, let's start with who I am now, I suppose, to give people a good idea of where we're going to go. I'm a prison reform campaigner. I'm also a Time to Change champion, which is a mental health awareness campaign led by Mind Rethink Mental Illness. All of that has come about after a successful disengagement from the criminal justice system after 40 years.
So you spent 40 years in prison?
Not in prison, no, as part of the criminal justice system. I was first arrested when I was 10 for criminal damage. And I was released from prison on my final sentence in 2015. My first prison sentence was a detention centre in 1985. And I suppose everything in between since then, it's been a journey and a half, that's for sure. So I kind of used this last prison sentence, if you like, as my final chance. I used it as a springboard to try and turn my life around, have one final go. I was so experienced. I had so many, if you like, skills and knowledge of the system. It was actually time to utilise it and put it to good use for me. The rest, as they say, is history.
So, gosh, I don't even know whether to start to explain what landed you in. Yeah, maybe I should just go there. And then I want to find out what happened that you changed, you just switched it all around. So what happened in your life that created 40 odd years in the criminal justice system? What's your story?
Sometimes it's quite difficult to explain because you feel like you're making excuses. However, it wasn't until 2010, and I spoke to a clinical psychologist. I was under a psychiatrist and under a clinical psychologist, and there was just something about him. The psychiatrist I was seeing at the time was his office was messy, his filing cabinets were always open, he was a health and safety nightmare in an office. But it just everything about him was scruffy, and he didn't get anything from me. But this clinical psychologist was your typical, stereotypical looking office. There was two leather armchairs either side of a fireplace. It was spotless, and I just knew that there was no chance that I was going to be able to, if you like, blag in. And I'm glad I didn't, because when I received his report back, or when the report was received, I kind of had reasons. I sort of then started to understand a bit more about me and what made me tick. And I sort of went back years. I mean, to begin with, I mean, I'm not moaning about my brothers and sisters, but I was the youngest of six, two brothers, three sisters. So growing up, there was always a lot of comparison. Oh, you're not like your brothers, you're not like your sisters. It's like, well, no, because I'm me. And I really was sort of, if you like, struggling for an identity. And then at the age of eight, I experienced a period of sexual abuse from a local toy shop owner. And then 2 years later, I contracted meningitis. And no one knew about the abuse because I never really... I mean, then you didn't really talk about it. And mental health didn't really exist. You was either mad or you were sane. That was it. There was no in between. There was no... I mean, I think even the DSM manual was still in its infancy in them days. So I kind of blamed myself for allowing myself to be abused, and my punishment was the meningitis. And a lot of my family have said that from that point, that was where, and I suppose with the, if you like, my first caution when I was 10 as well, that was where the coin turned. That was when I sort of just, well, I went off on one.
Did you at the time realise that you were, what you were thinking, your meningitis is my punishment for being abused? Did you know that, or is it years later that penny dropped?
That's only really sort of come out. I didn't deal with it until 2008.
Okay.
There was a fantastic TEDx talk by a lady called Madeline Black. This was quite recent. It's nothing to do with any reasons why. It's just, and she says in that about whatever we don't release leaks out of us in other ways. And unfortunately, for 30 odd years, 40 years, I allowed things to leak out the wrong way. I never really dealt with it. And as I say, in 2010, that was when I sort of begin to get the answers about me. But we're coming back in respect of, for me, change doesn't, there's no epiphany moment with change. For me, in respect to the criminal justice system, it's a process. It's something that builds up. And for me, that moment began back in 2005 when I was in HMP Blunderstone. And myself and a colleague were introduced to this new scheme that was being brought into prisons by charitable organisation called Shannon Trust. And it's really, I mean, it's so simple. It's just incredible. It's prisoners who can read teaching other prisoners who can't to read. It's that simple. And it was built up. But what we found as mentors, teaching someone to read, you build up this bond of trust. You build up this, I call it a trade of empathy. And they sort of open up and you start to find out the barriers and the hurdles and the obstacles to why they've sort of struggled with reading or education even. And from there, I mean, it was such an experience. I never get bored of telling this story. One of the guys who I taught to read had written a letter to his mum for the first time and had told her that he loved her. And what made that even more special was the fact that his mum was on a visit, or sorry, he was on a visit with his mum the same time I was on a visit with my people. And his mum came over to me and thanked me in the visit sort of HMP Blunderstone. I mean, that had such a profound effect on me. However, it didn't have an effect on me enough to challenge the character I was in society. I still wasn't right. But I found that giving back, if you like, I suppose that was the start of it all. And giving back was a sort of medication, if you like. It enabled me to put my own demons to one side for one moment and help others with theirs through my own experiences of, I mean, there isn't that many dissimilar stories in prison. It's just that we've all walked it slightly differently. You've got the route from being excluded from school, like I was at the age of 14. I was then kicked out of the follow-up schools you have, which are called pupil referral units now. And then in no time, I was in a children's home, then detention center and youth custody. So that's a story that's unfortunately very similar within the criminal justice system, and one that no doubt you've heard yourself a number of times as well, Penny. That really was, it was becoming a Shannon Trust mentor that was the catalyst for change within me. But it took me a few years to be able to deal with everything, and then be able to, if you like, utilise those resources that are available in prison. And you do get some good available resources in prison. Not at the moment, obviously, because of lockdown, but under normal regimes, then there are some good opportunities in there. But, I I decided the time was right. In a way, I haven't got out of prison. I'm just in a decat. England is my open prison, and so therefore, because of the work that I'm doing, I'm still running about on the landings. If that makes sense, it's obviously I was institutionalised. I didn't walk into prison and go, oh wow, look at this place, but it kind of grew on me, if you like. So yeah, it's 2005, Shannon Trust Mentor. That was when my life began to change for the worse, but also for the better.
So it took you some years before you thought, I'm done with this life and this lifestyle. And as much as you became accustomed to prison from what you're describing and got used to it and sort of maybe even began to like it a bit, you wanted something different. And it was do you remember that day? Was it over a period of time where you thought, I don't want to do another sentence? At the end of this sentence, that's it?
Well, I actually went back to prison on purpose this time. I was street homeless. I was living in a church doorway. I was on a cocktail of drugs, heroin and crack, cannabis, alcohol, sleepers, uppers, downers, inners, out. It was crazy times. And it was, ironically, in a conversation at 4 o'clock in the morning between two friends, two associates, that made me realise where I could make the change. And I'd lost everything. I'd lost everything dear to me. And the day I went to prison, the only thing that I possessed was a pair of boxer shorts and a pair of socks. Everything else had gone. Everything. My children were out of my life. My grandchildren, or my grandchild at the time, was out of my life. So it really was a case of, I've hit bottom a few times, but I now know that I never hit rock bottom. And it was time to make that change. And it was time, I suppose it was about just, if you like, it was as if, this is the way I look at it, for the last 40 years, I've been on a training course that set me up to do what I'm doing now. And I don't, are you aware of The Secret, the book by Rhonda Byrne, which talks about what they've received? Well, I read that in prison. I've read it a couple of times. It's one of those books that goes around prison a number of times. But this time I really got it. I really understood it. And I even sort of, I utilised the library less for entertainment this time and more for knowledge. I started to look at things a little bit differently and look at myself a little bit more using, I used transactional analysis, which is all about the adult, the child and the parent. I also looked at NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. But from that, I was looking, one, at how they created NLP, which was by looking at everyone at the top of the game and seeing how they got there and what they do, which obviously created modeling behavior. So I started to model my behavior on others. At that stage, it was more along the lines of Norman Parker, Mark Leach, Ben Gunn, Razor Smith, Noel Smith, who were all sort of synonymous with the prison system, if you like. They were all, they probably wouldn't mind me saying this, but at one point they were quite activists. But then they learned the language of the system, if you like, and they learned how to do it properly. And they rather than start letters go, oi, you'd start a letter of, according to precedent legal document, blah blah blah, and that's what I wanted to do. I had the intelligence for it. Just because I was kicked out of school didn't mean so I didn't have the intelligence. I just didn't have the attitude or the behavior. So it's, I knew exactly how and what I wanted to do, and that's what I utilized this last prison sentence for. And the thing was, I had to commit a crime that was going to give me enough time to be able to turn my life around. So the minimum I was thinking was 5 years. It's 2.5 years behind the door. Plenty of time for me to do what I wanted to do. And I ended up getting 3 years, 9 months. And funny enough, I was around about 6 months short of where I actually wanted to be when I was in prison.
So but you actually calculated what level of crime have I got to commit to get the right amount of time behind the door to improve myself?
Well, to a certain point, the crime, because of, I mean, I've blogged about this anyway, so I don't mind talking about it. As I say, it was early hours of the morning. A friend of mine, associate, was quite ill. We didn't have any money. We'd been talking about prison, hence why prison was on my mind. Didn't have any money. I'm not bragging or proud of this, but I could turn my hand to a few things in the criminal world. And I was probably that far off of reality in a way that any thought process wasn't rational. But to me, it was rational at the time. So it come down to armed robbery. Not a bank, so it had to be, and it was early in the morning. So I went out, and there was two places that I saw. One of them was a newsagent, and I didn't see the person, if you like. For me, the person that worked in the shop was a male, and that was one of the reasons why I chose that. The other place was a co-op, and there were women in there. It was a bit. I wouldn't have been able to have done that, I don't think. But when it come down to it, it was more, this person is in the way of the rest of my life. Now, regardless of the situation, and as I say, it's not a situation I'm proud of, but that was my thought process. You are in the way of the rest of my life, and I know what I'm going to be doing. So I don't want to say it went perfectly, but me sitting here talking to you now is sort of, if you like, evidence that it did. On the other side of the coin, had it have gone wrong, I'd be doing a life sentence. Now, at that point, one of the most important things for me to get back was my family, my children, my grandchildren. There's two there now. Still one. One turned up when I was in prison. So I wanted to get my children back. I've got a daughter and two sons. I needed them back in my life. And my friends as well. There's some friends, that close friends I wanted back in my life that I've lost contact with. I could have done that from prison on a life sentence, and I'd have been quite happy had I been. So really, for me, it was a win-win situation. I was either going to be sent to prison for the rest of my life, and though it's prison, still happy and comfortable, if that makes sense, or I was going to be given long enough to be able to turn my life around. And as I say,
did you ever get to say sorry to the guy in the newsagent?
I'm not sure. Obviously, because he was a victim within a crime, there's a certain process that you have to follow. And of course, part of my license conditions meant that I wouldn't be able to go near the place or contact the guy. So when you're in prison, what you have to do is, I wrote to the governor, and I wrote a letter that I sent with the letter to the governor to the victim. And explained what I've explained to yourself, that I really am sorry, but you was a means to an end. I'm trying to think what. There was no dramatics in there. There was no selling my life story to him or anything like that. It was really, I'm really, really sorry that this had to happen. It really was one of those things. Now, that sounds quite flippant, but it's true. What can I say?
And you don't know if that letter ever got to him?
No, I don't. No, it never. No, you don't really find things like that. So I'd like to think it did, but then I'd also like to think that because of what I do is quite public, it's sort of, on social media, that someone may have gone to me. Remember that guy that robbed the shop? Look what he's doing now. So there is a possibility of that. He could be listening to this. Who knows? And if he is, I apologize very much so. And as I mentioned, it wasn't the person, it was an object.
Yeah. And you used that as an opportunity to spend a 2 or 3 years working on you.
I did. Yeah.
And I find this is what I am knocked out by. I cannot believe the strength of character that somebody like you will require to change everything, the way you think, the way you behave. I mean, you obviously have values because you didn't want to hold up a woman. You wanted to hold up a man. And that, you know, it's will sound extraordinary to some people. Like, we obviously he's about to do armed robbery. He doesn't care, but you obviously do care. And so you do, you've obviously held some values from probably your family when you were growing up, but the strength of character you need to say, I'm not going to live this life again. And the focus and the determination, just talk me through how on earth you start to deinstitutionalize yourself and operate in a different way.
Well, that's, do you know what, you've hit the nail on the head there, Payne, deinstitutionalized. I wasn't, yes, I had drug and alcohol issues. That's by the by. 9 times out of 10, I had the money myself to be able to afford those. So therefore, I didn't have to commit crime to get them. It got to a point where recidivism wasn't an issue. Crime wasn't an issue. I had to fall out of love with prison. That was the tie that I needed to cut. And I'm going to be absolutely honest with you. I hadn't learned my final lesson. As soon as I mean, of course, when I went to prison, my heart was true. My intentions were pure, that I was going to turn my life around. What I didn't think was about my prison side, the prison behavior, because when you get to a certain level, I say level in prison, you get quite a bit of freedom in prison. Once you start playing the game, you get left alone, which means that you can do certain things. You're free. Yeah, you're free to find other enterprises when you get left alone. By that, I mean that there's more than one way of keeping a landing calm. And I don't mean through violence. I don't mean through intimidation. I mean through information. If you've got someone on your landing that's done a bit of bird, and you've got quite a few new people, or there's some aggy people about, you'll find that it's the experienced prisoner that does more to keep the landing calm than what it is the prison officers. Or it's the case of the more experienced prisoners working alongside, not with, but alongside the prison staff to keep. Because if you're in there, you want a quiet landing. And if you've done a bit of time, you know how to keep a landing calm without having to resort to anything stupid, as in violence or intimidation. And it's easy to do. So when you're like that, you get left alone. The landing gets left alone. So you're sort of free to do what you want as well. And I never took that on board. And I got straight back in. I was back in for a couple of months. I'd only been sentenced a month. I went to a CCAT park. This was HMP Norwich. And I become involved in drug trafficking with illegal highs, substances, psychoactive substances. Again, something I'm not proud of, but it was a part of me that was a part of prison that just went on. And it was as common as getting up in the morning, if that makes sense. So it was all part and parcel. And it all come on top. And it was a huge lesson because it was the same day that I got my DCAT. And they took my DCAT off me and I went back to BCAT conditions and I was on basic for 5 weeks. So that was a very, very harsh lesson to learn. And I nearly threw it all away. And it was an officer from Safer Custody that came over about 2 days after I was back in BCAT conditions. And you can imagine I'd spat my dummy out for these 2 days. I wasn't too pleased. And because I was angry at myself, but I was lashing out other people. And we had a really, really good chat. And it was her, it was her that made me realise that I expected too much. And obviously we talked about the fact that, yeah, I was changed. Because at the time I was doing a degree, I was a listener, I was a St. Giles peer advisor. So I was doing all the right things. I was also doing the wrong things. But in the eyes of a prisoner, also the right things. I then spoke to one of the governors and said, look, please give me another chance. This is, if you like, I hit rock bottom in society, and I hit rock bottom where my comfort zone was in prison. So it was time to go, do you know what? No, I can't do it. So I spoke to them and I said, look, give me another chance. And they did. I'm quite proud of saying that I had a DCAT review 8 months before I got out in the November of 2016. And they turned around and said, we're not going to give you a DCAT yet. We're going to wait and do a review in January. By the time January had come, I had, 6 months left. And it was like, do you know what? I'm really comfortable. I don't want my DCAT. It's just going to mess everything up. So I wrote to the governor and I said to him, look, blah, blah, everything that I was doing. I still had a couple of projects. I was creating a resettlement course based on my own experiences for the CCAT part of the prison. And I think it's still being run now, I hope. But, anyway. They gave me that opportunity and I turned it around. And I turned down my DCAT and he accepted it. And it was getting out was difficult. That was because I knew it was the last time. We were on lockdown that day and they were taking the guys to the kitchens and they were going to take me to reception. And they said, oh, we're getting transferred. I went, no, I'm getting out. And I'm like, well, at least be happy about it. It's like, you don't get it. This is now my time to fail. This is an opportunity for me to fail now. Not an opportunity for me to fail, sorry. This is that last chance. And I knew that getting out. I just knew it was going to be difficult getting out.
And I think for a lot of people getting out, because just my small experience of the system is that you're given 45 quid or whatever and you haven't got anywhere to go, you haven't got anywhere to stay, you're straight back to your drug den, whatever, and then you're back. What on earth did you do that day when you were released?
Well, this is another reason why I wasn't too pleased about getting out. Because of my crime, because my previous is all violence, they put me in a hostel, an approved premises, they're called probation bell hostels in Luton for 6 weeks. I had arranged all, I didn't find out until 28 days before I was released. And again, then I proper spat my dummy out. I was going to be working with this organization called Future Projects in Norwich. On the Monday, they were going to be coming in. This was about 13th, 14th, 15th of May. Because on the 11th of May, which was a Thursday, that was the day that I found out from probation that I was going to have to go to this hostel after arranging all of my support network in Norwich. I thought, all right, fair enough. So I weren't happy with that. And then on the Monday, that's when Future was supposed to be coming in and they couldn't get in. So for me, it was like those two things were just signs that that's it. I've had enough. I can't be. I'm not going to bother. Unfortunately, our education manager at the time at HMP Norwich, who I know won't mind me mentioning her name, Deb Stewart, she just made me think the right thoughts, and she put me in my place. again, I keep saying it, but the rest is history. Mm. And there's so many stops along the way where things could have been so much different negatively if it wasn't for the positive support that I received from individuals along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you describe how you had lots of changes of heart, changes of mindset, but they also collided with the right people being around you as
well.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah, listen, of course. Do you know, this is what frustrates I can't speak now. This is what frustrates me when it comes to our prison system. It's as if we all expect prisons to rehabilitate. They don't. They're buildings. They cannot. It doesn't matter if it's a Victorian building, if it's in the segregation unit, which is the naughty boy part of the prison. if you're bad in prison, they bang you up. It's like, we're going to lock me up. I forgot what I was going with that.
It's the building, it's not the building that can rehabilitate you.
It's the people. It's the people. First and foremost, it's you. Because unless you're willing, no one can do anything to help you. But when you're willing, no one can stop you. I mean, it's just once you start on that road, once, don't forget, I've had a life of being compared or being put down or being told that I'm crap or told I'm scum by the courts and sent to prison and so on and so forth. And now here I am. People, you're wonderful. I find it very difficult still to accept praise. It's so much easier for me to accept criticism than it is praise. But I'm getting better at it. I'm getting better at it, that's for sure. And I'll tell you what, don't I make you feel better as well?
Yeah. But you look remarkably relaxed and happy. And I'm still really struggling how you've only been out a couple of years. And you're 3 years. You're involved in prison reform.
Yep.
What is it that would make the difference? You've just described how the right people at the right time makes the difference.
Yep.
So what? How do you see prison reform? If you're campaigning for prison reform, in what form? What format?
Well, let's call it the three P's. You've got the prisoner, the people, and the policy. Or you could even have the three P's as the people, the policies, and pound notes. Those are the three things that will make the difference. To have the right people, that is obviously down to the training. The prisoners, 95% of people in our prisons don't actually want to be in there, believe it or not. And then when you take a little bit more of a step back, 11 million people in this country have got criminal records. So there's more in common with our population than people probably care to think about. And we need, alongside that, we need a society that actually does believe in second chances and redemption. We seem to be able to give these, I don't want to say fake celebrities because they're real celebrities, but we seem to give celebrities second chances hand over fist, even when some of their, let's say, events are a lot left to be desired. I mean, having said that, you look at Andy McParland, I mean, him, drink driving, and yet here he is now still back on TV presenting. It's like, come on, people. It's like, if you can give second chances like that, why not give second chances to real people that probably haven't had the life chances that people like that have had? They've had to struggle through life. Yet there are some bad people in prison, but then there are also some bad people in prison doing some incredibly good things.
Well, you were a bad person in prison for a period of time, and you're obviously not a bad person. You just hadn't had the pennies hadn't dropped. You hadn't had realizations, met the right people. But you doesn't sound like you were ever a bad person.
I was a fruit loop. I didn't even know who I was. I was a kaleidoscope of personalities. Even I'd have to introduce myself to myself in the mirror each morning. I really, obviously that was down to the drugs, that was down to alcohol, that was down to trauma. And that's another thing. It's like, such and such is a gateway, such as trauma is the gateway, childhood trauma. And that, if you like, again, is where if the best work for the prison reform is to be proactive with our youth to stop them getting into the system to begin with. That is how you reform the system. You begin at the beginning and we look at the way we treat the kids with respect to exclusions, how we run our pupil referral units, secure units even. I think we've still got a hell of a long way to go in the value we place on our younger generation, I think. And if you like, until we start investing real money and real resources into our youth, then they are the future prisoners, if you like. So it makes sense to me, if we spend a huge budget now on the youth, we're going to save 10 times as much in the future, because not only will they not become parts of the criminal justice system, the likelihood is, because of the support and the finance being spent on them now, they're going to be a tax-paying member of society. So they'll be putting back rather than taking it. Just, for me, it's just simple. Mm. It doesn't make sense. We need to do more for our youth, I think, and especially our youth that are in.
But David, if somebody had taken you when you were in your youth, would that have worked? Did you not have to do the 40 years of self-discovery?
I think I did. I think we all have. And then you have people like, if you don't mind mentioning someone else, LJ Flanders, who is cell workout. First time in prison, and he is now a successful businessman. He just saw... He basically was in his cell, wanted to keep fit, and then thought, hold on a minute, is there any exercises for this? And there wasn't. So he wrote a book about it. and he appears in Inside Times, which is a newspaper for prisoners. He, as I say, he's got his own business. And also he's now got to a point where he's got clothing called Made in HMP label, being made in prisons by prisoners, learning a track. It's just an incredible, if you want an inspiration, LJ Flanders, cell workout, Penny, honestly, that is one guy you need to speak to. It's great because when I was in jail, and I still speak to my former education manager as well, she's not in the prison system anymore. And so she can back my story up and does so, and has done. But LJ, I come across LJ when I was in prison. I was doing some work with National Prison Radio, and one of their arms, if you like, is called We Are Straight Line. It's an app and an online website that you can go to, and it's for people coming out of prison, and it's stories by people that we've lived the experience of prison. So they're motivational stories, inspirational stories. There was a video on there from LJ, and I was like, I really, really like what this guy is about. And it was obviously, this was towards the end of my sentence, so it was at the good part of my prison me. And I said to Debs, I said, listen, we've got to get this guy in for a talk. I said, this guy is so inspirational. So even back then, and that was his early days, he was just sort of getting started back then. So I saw something. I haven't made him. I haven't got him out there, and I had no effects on that whatsoever. But I just love everything that he's about. And for me, him and John McAvoy, who you probably are aware of, they are the epitome of what can be, the hashtag that I use. And it's about, yeah, okay. And I think they're also, if you think that you've got these first-timers entering the prison system and they're able to turn their lives around, then for me it just proves that it isn't the environment, because first-timer going into prison would normally just hide themselves away. They're not gonna spot business opportunities, do you know what I mean? So it does go to show that when it comes, for me, rehabilitation, people talk about it as if it's a destination in respect to our criminal justice system, but it's not. It's a journey. We adapt our attitude. We reform our character, but we don't change. We're still us. It's just that we're better versions of who we once were.
So what's life like for you now? What do you do every day? How do you manage? And
I love life. I still get up at the same stupid time I did in prison, 4 o'clock in the morning.
No, you serious?
Well, yeah, I would have think. This is going to sound really strange, but I didn't get a lot of time to myself in prison. I really didn't, because of the jobs that I'd done. I was education mentor as well in a number of classes. So, and I was also studying for a degree. When I was placed, again, I had this in my mind because of the resources that I knew were available. The first thing I'd done when I was put on remand was put in a grant for a Prisoners Education Trust, Prisoners Education Trust grant, so that I could do an access module. Because I knew I wanted to prove all those teachers that wrote in my school reports before I got kicked out of school that if only David applied himself. And I thought, you know what? What if David did apply himself? So that was one of it. And the other reason as well is I wanted to get onto the degree. I'm doing Bachelor of Science in Criminology and Psychological Studies, halfway through it now. I wanted to, again, going back to who my sort of role models were in respect to the activist side, I wanted to learn how to construct an argument, what I wanted to say, not just for my assignments and the essays for the degree I was doing, or the modules I was doing, but also for me to be able to, and to write to people like Robert Buckland and for them to listen or read, but and Lucy Fraser and people like that. And that's what I've been doing. I've just come out. I had to spend 6 weeks in a hostel in Luton. I then had to spend another 6 weeks in a hostel in Norwich, one that I'd been to before and had been recalled from twice before on two different sentences. So there was that to get through as well. And for me, once I got out, and I actually got out there, I was supposed to be there 6 weeks, I got out at five. Because if you imagine, I've been there twice before, I've been recalled twice before. They was expecting a certain person to be turning up, and all of a sudden they got this guy walking through the door. It's like, who's this? So it's quite easy for me, for them to compare who I was to who I am. And so it was like, wow. Because they would have seen, it was like, they would have seen a huge difference, because the last time they saw me, I was being dragged off back to prison. And now they're seeing me again, it's this completely different person. Unfortunately, I don't know, but, and then after that, I was then sort of trapped in the supported accommodation route. I nearly got out, 9 months before I eventually did. But the landlord of the place I was going to be renting found out about a criminal record and was like, nah. Right at the last minute. I was waiting for an email from the agent to go and sign the contract. That's how close we were. All the money's been paid, everything. I managed to get the money back, but that was thanks to the hostel because they were involved. But yeah, it was that was a bit of a kick in the teeth. So it's not been plain sailing since I've been out, don't get me wrong. I still had issues with my mental health, and I believe it or not, made the decision in prison to give up my medication, my mental health medication. And funny story attached to that as well, that I was on NWIN, which is like the enhanced one, if you like. It was port cabins, still shit, but they were like the Holiday Inn, if you like, of HMP Norwich. But the lads on my landing, after about 5 weeks of me being off medication, it was done tongue-in-cheek, but they put a petition in asking for me to get put back on my medication. But after 6 weeks, I really did start to level off. Well, I think I have. And people have noticed as well. People do notice the difference. And I'm still getting better as well. I'm getting stronger, more coping mechanisms. Doing what I do is a coping mechanism, making a difference, as I don't really have a plan. I suppose the goal is to leave a legacy that my great-grandchildren would be proud of, or their children. How I get there, I don't really care, as long as along the way I'm going to make a difference. And I know that I am, through messages that I receive through my blog, and DMs on social media. So life is just, it's just great. Absolutely fantastic. It really is.
So as you're talking, I'm thinking of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the 12th step, am I right in thinking, is help someone else?
Well, yeah.
It's so good for you to help others. It makes you feel good, but it's important for them to have the support. It's almost the most healing thing you can do is help another, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think evidence of that, all right, fair enough, there are other variables involved in my life that needed to take place or were still going on at the time. However, becoming a Shannon Trust mentor, giving back, which then led on to me becoming a Samaritan's Trained Listener, which kind of was another level of deep understanding, if you like, of other prisoners and their lives, because it's more confidential. Obviously, the Samaritans, you can understand the sort of conversations someone would have with a Samaritan, so therefore it's no different to that. So those two situations alone of giving back, just like I say, yeah, it did take me a while to be able to, if you like, put that in as part of the package when I was ready to actually change me or reform me. But that was incredible. It was an incredible experience of seeing what something as simple as teaching someone to read could do, and the ripple effect that creates. Because obviously it made me feel better. Therefore, the people I spoke to felt better. My family members felt better because I was buzzing on the phone to them. So it's just exponential. It's endless when you start looking at the ripple effect.
So I want to ask you about your mental toughness, and I will do that. But is the one thing that you really struggle with to cope with or manage since, or have you sort of got everything in a good place?
No, not really. No, I don't think we're ever fully in control of ourselves, especially when you're living with mental health. I still get social anxiety. This Zoom, I love it. Zoom, podcasts. This period of lockdown, and I'm sorry to people that have lost loved ones and have had sad times and moments, but for me, it's been a blessing in disguise. It's kind of, I'm in society's prison, and everyone's with me now. We're all on the same level. I've got a captive audience as well. So for me, it's been, as I say, it's been a blessing in disguise. But I've been attending quite a few webinars, quite a few Zoom events, and online, talking online. And it's like all the fun of an event, but with none of the social awkwardness afterwards. And because I'm not stressed about having to speak to that person, this person, that person, try and find something to be able to talk about every time. Sometimes I get bored of hearing myself. So it's nice to obviously chat to people like yourself, new people, even though it's the same stuff, but there are some things that I just won't ever bore of talking about.
Yeah, but it sounds to me like your confidence in dealing with other people might be something that is still not completely nailed.
No, I don't think I'll ever get that right, to be honest. I still, my mum passed away 3 weeks after my 21st birthday. And I've always, because of my behaviour, I've always held a lot of guilt over that. However, I like the fact that I feel guilt over being a shit when my mum was younger and died at the age of 59. I why shouldn't I? Because, I mean, yeah, fair enough, it might not have been my fault, but I didn't help. I wasn't part of the solution, I was part of the problem. So I'm quite happy to carry that guilt. As far as I'm concerned, and again, it matters not to anyone else, but my mum's my guardian angel. My mum's watching over me. So it's something that I find of comfort. That's it, really.
So the definition of mental toughness is your ability to cope with the stress, the pressure, and the challenges of life. If you cope with those things well, you're mentally tough. If you don't cope with them quite so well, you're mentally sensitive. Are you mentally tough, David Breakspear?
I am now. I wasn't, because I use, as I say, I use a cocktail of drugs and alcohol to provide me with fake strength. And if you like, papering over the cracks. But unfortunately, all that happens there is, anyone that's redecorated a Victorian house, when you start papering over one crack, the other one appears, and another one appears, and another one appears. And before you know it, either your wall's fallen down, the house has fallen down. So it's always best. It's good to talk. It's as simple as that. talking therapy. I've done it myself, counselling with the clinical psychologist who, although under different circumstances, allowed me to understand and get a grasp of who I am and why I am.
Does that psychologist know what impact he had on you?
I doubt it very much, to be honest. I've never spoke to him since. But Darren Spooner, his name was. He was in the St Giles Centre in Norwich. And I know he's no longer there. I think he's private practice now. I don't know. Who knows? Could be on social media, just hiding behind the curtain sort of thing and seeing what I'm doing. Who knows? He might not even remember me. He probably had hundreds of clients. So who knows?
Yeah. I mean, the wonderful thing for me, because I'm all about mental toughness and helping people to develop it, because people do, people can.
Yeah.
You know, you're stuck with the genes you're born with, aren't you? But you can always do something to develop your resilience or your confidence or your commitment or whatever. And you are a shining, shining, shining example of that. It's just an absolute pleasure to talk to you. You are ridiculously inspiring. If you can do what you've done, I just hope anybody listening to this can just get a tiny morsel of inspiration from it to show that they can do stuff too.
Exactly. Success is subjective. And it's subjective to the individual. So it's also about setting yourself the right expectations for you, not the right expectations for your mum and dad, not for your girlfriend, not for your boyfriend, not for your next door neighbour who lives down the road with a pet parrot. None of them. It's always, always. Yes, it's selfish, but you have to be selfish, because if you're not selfish to yourself in respect of self-care, you're not going to, all right, in years' time, you might have the lived experience to help somebody else, but who wants to go through a life like that? Do you know what I mean? So the sooner you can get things sorted, the better.
So I just want to end with one question, which is, if you had to give one bit of advice to David Breakspear when he was 21, or if there's something you could have said to the younger you, what might it have been that would have made a difference 20 years previously?
Honestly, Penny, I don't know. I don't know what would have made the difference to me back then. Sometimes I'm not saying that our lives are destined, because it comes down to the choices and decisions that we make. And I think each and every one of us along the journey have exit signs that we don't spot. So I would have had a high number exit signs I didn't spot, so it'd be very difficult, if you like, to be able to focus on one thing and say, right, Dave, this is, to be honest, crack on, bruv, it's going to turn out great in the end. That really is the advice that I would give. Unfortunately, mate, things are going to get a bit rough for a little while, but believe you me, it's going to be worth it. And it is, Penny. I mean, I know it's all cliche, but I am having the time of my life. It's just, I run down the stairs at 4 o'clock in the morning. My computer is the first thing I put on before the kettle. I love what I do, and it enables me to stay in control of who I am as well.
I just think you're amazing, David, honestly.
Thank you. So I could talk for hours about you. I mean,
no, I don't want to talk about me. It's just embarrassing in the context of what you've achieved. I just want to say thank you. Maybe we'll do another one.
Please do.
Other stuff, but I want to say a massive thank you for spending the time. And I just hope somebody's listening that will get some inspiration to do something different as a result of hearing you. And I'm sure they will.
Well, I do it. That's why I do it. It's there really is no rhyme, no rule. I don't want fame or fortune. I want change and reform. Do you know what I mean?
I believe you.
I know what's needed to make things different. And I just need to be listened to. That's all.
Well, I hope lots of people have listened to you just now.
Thank you, Penny.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's so funny, because before this you said, you used to watch me on TV in prison, which is hilarious.
Crazy.
It never crossed my mind in those days that people would be in prison watching me, but isn't that funny? We get to meet properly at last, almost properly.
Well, no, I think this is new norm anyway, isn't it?
Well, I'm really rather looking forward to meeting people in person.
I do people in.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, you're welcome, Penny. Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.